It's good to be back with you. We're in Romans chapter 9 and 10. I'd like you to turn there if you wouldn't mind. In the last 3 weeks, I've been working. I've not been preaching here on Sunday morning, but you have a section of a few weeks where I get to work on things that's coming for this next year. So we've been working on Exodus, which is the next book that we'll follow when we get through with Romans. And in fact, in particular, I'll be doing a series on the Ten Commandments as you're studying through the book of Exodus in your Bible school classes. And so I appreciate the chance to have a few weeks where you're not working on that week's sermon so you can work on what's coming. Because you don't get these long sermons by accident. I mean, you've got to work at it. I'm telling you, I've got to check the internet on a regular basis and look for things. But anyhow, I appreciate Kevin and Jay very much. Those guys are nuts. I'm telling you that right now. But I will tell you, they are godly nuts. Both of them, genuine. I'm behind the scenes with them on a consistent basis, and I will tell you, there are two men who have integrity in every part of their life. They've embarrassed me in every restaurant in town. They humiliate me on a regular basis. And I'm hoping in heaven they straighten up. But right now, I'm telling you, I don't know of two Christian brothers that I respect more than those two. Thank you, guys. There's a word that we learned as little kids. It just sort of happened automatically. It's the word fair. The idea is that's not fair. And how in particular we mean that is that's not fair to me. That's what we mean on a regular basis. We use that word a lot on things. Maybe you were the kid who put the club together and somehow they all took your club and kicked you out of your own club. Maybe that wasn't fair. We all know that word. I'm guessing that word fair would have been a word that would have felt like it's a word you wanted to say if you were a Jewish Christian inside the church at Rome. Now, the church at Rome, don't you picture anything too highfalutin and fancy. It would have been house churches. It would have been meeting together in large assemblies when they could. But the church at Rome, but it would have felt odd if you were a Jewish Christian. The whole time you were a Jewish man or woman growing up, you would have grown up right in the middle of a Jewish community. They taught you to love the one God. They taught you about the scriptures. They taught you how to worship. You spent your whole life with Hiram and Benjamin and Jude. And these Jewish men and women that you were around, they were a part of your life. And they told you to watch for the Messiah. And the Messiah came and you followed the Messiah and you gave your life to the Messiah. But now you're sitting in church on Sunday mornings or Sunday nights or whenever the church could meet. And you look around the room and all of this deep, rich Jewish heritage you grew up with, it's not here. Oh, there's a Jewish man or woman here or there, but you look around and vast majority of these are people that, quite frankly, they're not like you. But they're the ones telling neat stories of what God has done. They're the ones telling stories of redemption. They're the ones telling stories of the Holy Spirit. And all your Jewish friends, they're somewhere else, not following the Messiah. You look around and you go, this isn't fair. In fact, when you start looking, you begin to say things to yourself like, God, that isn't fair. You used us Jews to win people we don't even like. You used us, but you didn't save us. All those years of us carrying the scriptures and us bringing the Messiah, you used us, but we're not here at the end. God, this isn't right. Sense of fair. If you don't mind me upgrading that illustration slightly, that's the background of chapter 9. Those of you that are kind of new to Christianity, this is kind of a new thing to you. You're not really sure the jargon of the language and the lingo, and you're not sure how this works. You can plug your ears up for a little while, kind of hum to yourself if you don't mind, because I want to talk to those of you who the lingo you do know and the lineage you do come from. I want to talk to those of you that have a really strong background in the church. You see, I think you understand what that Jewish gentleman might feel like. I think there's a good chance you understand it very well. You see, you grew up in the church. You cut your teeth serving in the church. You grew up in a Christian home, and you knew how to pronounce Nebuchadnezzar. Nobody else did, but you did. And you knew when somebody said, turn to the book of Hezekiah, that that was just a trick because there's no such book. Everybody else is turning to Hezekiah in the front of the book, but you knew. And you made a deal with God a long time ago. The deal that you made with God is that I'll be here. And so you were here, and you've been here through hundreds, if not thousands, of bad classes and bad long sermons. But you were here. And you were here when they needed help in the nursery. And you worked week after week in the nursery. And you were here when they needed cookies for everything under the sun. And you were here when they needed ushers and greeters. And you were here when they said to take up an offering. In fact, you look around here, most everything you see was bore on your back. You paid for these things. Because you were here. You were here when nobody else was. And now then, God begins to blow his spirit and his grace into people's lives, and it's everybody's story but yours. There are people telling stories of what God's doing in their life, and they're over here, and people telling stories over here what God's doing, and over here, and you're going, wait a second. Wait a second. I'm the one who's been here. I'm the one who's done all this. I've been the donkey who's pulled the plow. And God, what are you doing over here and here and here and where? And who are all these weird people? And where'd they come from? What bus is pulling up out here? God, when you do something, you ought to do it with those of us that have had the stability in the background. God, it feels like you're using us, but giving the blessing to somebody else. There's an essential principle in this text. An essential principle that everybody who ever understood what it's like to have privilege and responsibility in the church. There's an essential principle that you better hang on to. That essential principle is this. Privilege / responsibility is no substitute for surrender. Privilege / responsibility is no substitute for surrender. In fact, God said, I want you to know that those of you who have always carried the privilege and the responsibility, I want you to know you're often going to be shocked. You're going to be often surprised. Because when you look up and see what I'm doing, I don't do it with the people you thought I would. And the glory goes somewhere else. Look here in this text, Romans chapter 9. Look at starting to verse 25. Hosea, one of the prophets in the Old Testament, said, this is how it'll be. Hosea said, as indeed he says in Hosea, those who are not my people, I will call my people. And she or her who was not beloved, I will call my beloved. And in the very place where they said, you're not my people, there in that place, they will be called sons of the living God. Here's what he says. You're going to drive through neighborhoods and you're going to see people and you're going to be so offended at their arrogance and so offended at their lifestyle and so offended the way they've lived and the way they've thrown away their lives, and you're going to look up and find that's the very neighborhood God is breathing a fresh wind through, and you're going to see grace come to that neighborhood, and you're going to see that very neighborhood change and experience the hand of God. You're going to go through places where the drug addicts and the drunks and those that are living at the other extreme, and you say, wow, those are not the people of God. And you're going to turn around and find those are the very ones God raises up to lead, that those are his people. In the very neighborhood you said, wow, they're a long way away, that's the one I'll make my people. Well, what about those of us who've been here? What about old rock, faithful, rock steady me? I've been here. I've been in the church. What about me? And I know I'm using a parallel here, but verse 27. Isaiah says it's not good news about you. It's got not good news. And Isaiah cries out concerning Israel. Though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sands of the sea, only a remnant of them, only a handful will be saved. For the Lord will carry out his sentence upon the earth fully and without delay. And as Isaiah predicted, if the Lord of hosts hadn't left us a few children, we'd have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah are places that are made destitute. And he uses the parallel. That's what it's like for those who've been carrying the plow, who had privilege and responsibility. They didn't make it, and the ones on the outside made it. No wonder you would say, wait a second, God, this isn't fair. How come other people tell stories of your grace? And I was here, and I don't get to. If you don't mind, let me use myself. In the words of someone else, my gig is pretty good. Last hour I said that and somebody didn't understand what I meant and was kind of bothered by what I said. But in the words, my gig's pretty good. I mean, I can't fuss on that. I've been here 26 years. I'm in my 27th year here at College Heights. I get to stand on the stage in a bit of a spotlight. From the time we were little bitty kids, we pulled on pant legs and tried to get people to hush so we could tell our story, and they'd all hush while we talked. And you all hush, and I get to talk. For the most part, you hush. My gig's pretty good. I go to restaurants, and it's not that I choose it. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just reporting for kind of as an outsider might see it. I'm stopped on a regular basis, Mr. Garris. I stand in a movie ticket line, Mr. Garris. What I do here, my gig's not bad. I'm treated pretty well here. I got privileges. Behind that wall back there, you can't see it. It's called a green room. It has snacks back there. You can't have them, but I can. I mean, it's food. Don't go back there, okay? God will strike you down. It's a holy of holies. No. My gig's not bad. I have keys. I have two keys. Those two keys in particular will open everything in this building almost. Which means that my kids and grandkids, we can go out here play in the gym late at night, those sort of things. Man, my deal's not bad. Now, if I were having a conversation with God, I would say to God, God, you know, though, I'm trying not to take advantage of this thing. You know that, don't you? And God, I work hard. I work hard. You know that, don't you, God? And God would say back, yes, Randy, you work hard. You do. You don't always work smart, but you work hard. And I would say, God, you know at times I work really hard, and times it's really painful in the kinds of things that I work with. And God would say, yes, Randy, I know it's really hard and sometimes painful what you do. And I would say, God, and you're the one who gave me this privilege and responsibility. And God would say, yes, Randy, I did. And so I would say back to God, God, that probably means this privilege and responsibility means I'm in, then, doesn't it? I mean, it means I'm in, doesn't it? And God would say, no. All of that does not mean you're in. Because, Randy, there's a principle in this text. You have to understand that privilege and responsibility are no substitute for surrender. Randy, you're a temporary resident of a stage. Temporary tenant. Somebody else had it before you, and someone will have it after you. Randy, the keys were checked out to you, and somebody else would have the keys after you. Randy, I will use you. But Randy, whether I use you or not is a separate question from whether or not you're in, because privilege and responsibility are no substitute for surrender. I say all of that, and I know I take a little bit of time to say that one of the most dangerous things that ever occurs to people who have had privilege and responsibility within the kingdom, who understand the lingo and know how to live it, is we start leveraging what we have. We start leveraging what we have. I leverage God. In the 26 years worth something, isn't it kind of like a bunch of coupons I can give you? And God says, no, it's really not. Well, God, can I leverage you, the wife I married? I mean, look at the wife I married. Can I leverage that? And no, you can't leverage her either. Well, what about the wife I didn't marry? Can I leverage that one? No, you can't leverage that. Well, what about all of the pornography I didn't look at? Can I leverage that? No, you can't leverage that. What can I trade in? Because God, I've been doing all this for you. And God says, you need to understand there's a real danger of identity theft. You see, the identity theft is, Randy, you've been building all this, and you've been spray painting my name on it, but let's be honest, it's about like the same thing as taking somebody else's credit cards and buying your own gig. It's kind of like using my name to get what you wanted. Randy, the issue is not whether or not you have privilege and responsibility. I gave that to you. But Randy, They'll never substitute for surrender. And the one great problem within the people of God has always been, we got that mixed up. And that's exactly what's taking place here in this ninth chapter. God has a very singular agenda. That agenda is that God is calling you into a relationship with Him so that you can reach others. But if you reject the first part, where God calls you into a personal relationship with Him and a surrendered faith in Him, if you reject that, He's still going to use you to accomplish the second. He may still put you in positions of privilege and responsibility, but don't ever mistake that for being in with God. In this text, or names that may not mean anything to you, names like Esau and Pharaoh and the nation of Israel and implication of several other names. All those basically mean are these. In the ninth chapter, God says, I have a habit and a pattern that I will choose people, even people who are not in with me, but I will use them to accomplish my means. I am the sovereign God, and I have an unrelenting end. I want to call all men to the grace in Jesus Christ. And if you don't surrender, don't think I'm done with you. I'll still use you, but I'll use you as the stepping stone to accomplish what I want. If you're in this room and you're not a Christian person and you have nothing to do with Christian things and you say, wow, you know, I appreciate you getting on to those religious hypocrites kind of like you are. I understand what you're saying to them. You're kind of getting on to them for thinking they have something when they really don't. But please, I'm one of those that has nothing to do with God. I run off over here and God isn't going to use me because I have nothing to do with Him. Don't kid yourself. You can run from God as far as you want to, and I promise you, you will be used by God. He will use you as a mark of derision, as a mark of laughter, as a mark of mockery. Your children, your grandchildren won't want your heart. They won't want your attitude. They won't want your disposition. They won't even want your money for the things you think they'll use your money for. They will take your money, and eventually your children, your grandchildren will come back because they'll understand the truth. God used you to win their hearts, and they will bring everything that you didn't want to give to God, and they will come lay it at His feet. Don't you everything. Every string eventually ties back to the King. You're somebody who says, I want nothing to do with God. I don't care if your name's Pharaoh. You're going to find out I use you to bring other people to me. If, on the other hand, you go to the other extreme and you say, wow, I'm going to get really right here in the middle of the church so I can't miss anything, so I can leverage everything I do so that I can take my goodness and present it to God, and I can be gooder, and God will trade in all the things that I'm good at. And somehow it'll mean something to Him. And His answer is no, no. Surrender is the only thing that means anything. That's the only thing that means anything. But I'll take you. I'll put you behind the pulpit. I'll let you preach for lots of years. But this gig, as you might call it, this gig was about how I used you. There is no substitute for surrender. One of the realities is I'm dealing with God. And God will have His way. And I can either be a part of it and enjoy the privilege and the responsibility and the wonderful grace of it all, or I can have the privilege and responsibility and miss the grace of it all. But either way, He's God, He's using me. That's chapter 9. Chapter 10. He basically will say there's a second principle that is incredibly important you need to understand that. And you can't leverage anything in place of this second principle. And that is, he says, that being right with God is incredibly simple. I didn't say easy, but being right with God is incredibly simple. Look in chapter 9, verses 30 to 33. Here in particular is where he's going to lead into what the 10th chapter does. What then shall we say that Gentiles, those outsiders, who didn't even pursue righteousness or being right with God, they've attained it? People who weren't even chasing it got it? That is a righteousness that is by faith. But that Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. They have stumbled over the stumbling stone. As written, behold, I lay in Zion, or Jerusalem, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Whoever believes in Him will not be put to shame. Here's the great danger. There are two groups of people. There are those who cry out, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, and who understand a simple truth that the only righteousness I'll ever have is because Jesus Christ gives me His. I could never be good enough, deep enough, smart enough, or served enough. I could never voucher in enough things. I could never give you all the offering receipts I've ever got at the end of the year, so to speak, and ever earn anything with God. I have nothing to bring him. By faith, I accept. Or you can be someone who says, I think my life kind of speaks a little for itself. I think I've earned a little. And if you fall into the second, I don't care who you are, you'll miss Christ. You'll miss Christ. And that's what he says in this text. In fact, he says Jesus is offensive in his salvation. Because you labored and you worked hard and you did all these things and you did and you did and you did and you did. And you said, here I am, God, look how hard. But you lost surrender somewhere in the process, somewhere you slipped into a gig. The story of the prodigal son is really important. We got to take a second on it. Why did Jesus tell the story of the prodigal son? You know, if you didn't know its context, here's what you'd think. It's about somebody who leaves and goes off and wastes and ruins his life and thinks he can never be accepted again, and he comes home and finds out the father really accepts him. So what you would think on the surface is God found somebody who was so distraught over their sins, somebody so broken, and somebody said, God, you could never accept me. And so Jesus said, well, let me tell you a story about a prodigal son, because anybody can be accepted. Now, that's a great theory, a great idea, but it's not why God told it. In fact, it has nothing to do with why God told the story of the prodigal son. And if they'll put on the screen for you, Luke 15, verses 1 and 2, here's why he tells it. In verse 1, Jesus is spending time with all these sinners. And all these sinners are close to him. But they're not the ones struggling with it. In verse 2, it's the scribes and the Pharisees who are muttering, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. They were ticked. They were angry. How can you include those people when we've had privilege and we've had responsibility and we've been the donkeys pulling the plow and you include them? And so Jesus starts telling a series, parables. He tells the story of the prodigal son, but he still tells the story of the prodigal son because it's not the prodigal son he's talking about. It's the second son who's the star of the show. Come on down to verse 25. I think that's the verse. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. This is after the prodigal son has come back. And when he came and near the house and he heard the music and the dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him, what's going on? Your brother has come, he replied. Your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back safe and sound. And the older brother became angry and refused to go in. And his father went out and pleaded with him. Do you recognize it starts with we're ticked by who you're including? And the story of the older brother. The great danger always, these guys like myself started out as a prodigal son, but I forgot it. And I became the older brother. And I slip into what somebody said this morning. They weren't comfortable with my word gig, and I appreciate that. Because we slip into a gig. I apologize to many of you who have not grown up around the church, and I apologize to many of you who have grown up in the church. Sometimes some of the church people are just really some of the worst people on the face of the earth. You want to know why? It's because that word that was up here a minute ago, you don't have to put it back. The word angry. Just angry. God, how dare you use us and take our offerings and use us in the nursery and use us for everything you do, and yet your spirit moves in other people and God answers back, yes, but here's why. You lost surrender. It slipped through your fingers. And anybody who understands surrender, anybody who understands Jesus is Lord and Christ and surrender and brokenness, those I'll use. Man, you got to watch anger and pride like. And that's always a battle. I'm being a bit more transparent probably than I should be. I'm treated very, very well around here. Treated very well. Oh, thank you. I didn't know Mom was here today, but I appreciate it. Knew it wasn't my wife. She knows better, but... We're getting a series of anonymous notes, and we get anonymous letters. I mean, that comes all the time. That comes to the territory. I just want to tell you, we're happy to visit with any of you face-to-face. Would be honored to visit with you face-to-face. But an anonymous note is really one of the more ungodly things you can do. And I mean, they happen all the time. It's just price of doing business for ministry as you get them. This one I got last week, I guess probably just causes me, it's because of the text. All it put was Revelation chapter 3, started set of verses. You can guess which verses. College Heights is, and started in. You think you're a poor church. You think you're rich. You're lukewarm. I'm going to spew out of my mouth. I mean, it's just a pretty straightforward, just an anonymous note. I'm going to be real blunt with you. Anytime you're around the church, you're going to deal with angry religious people. And people who are mad because what God's doing is it feels like their church is being stolen and it's given to other people and things are happening that they don't want and they've been the ones who've been pulling the plow and they have a privilege and a right and responsibility and somebody gave them a set of keys and lo and behold, the keys don't turn out to mount anything and lo and behold, there's a new thing God's doing and he's not doing it with us and you guys seem to have the wrong people in mind and you guys are lukewarm. There's something wrong with this church. That's always an older brother. And every time we ever gather, there's a danger any of us becomes the older brother. Angry people. That's what's happened in Romans 9 and 10. And in this passage, there's this great warning. Don't fight against God. On a personal note, and I'm taking this a little further than I should, and Lynn's back there doing, you know, watching the time. One of us should. I read this last week. That there was a fireman were called to a house on fire. And when they went to the houses on fire, tried to fight the fire, there was a sniper who kept shooting at them, killed one or two firemen. I kind of think that's really what happens on anonymous letters and sometimes kingdom work. I think there's a sense of, wow, this is my church and somebody's stealing it from me and somebody's making it different. And how come all these outsiders and people who are laboring hard, trying to call people back to the gospel of grace. I hate to see some of my co-workers and elders shot at. A God of grace will always be working with people who understand brokenness. And there will always be anger from those of us who slip into the older brother. In this text, he gives the great principle. Never confuse your privilege and your responsibility for surrender. And secondly, this salvation is incredibly simple. It has to do with the idea of what? Well, chapter 10, read down verses 6 through 11. Chapter 10, here's how salvation is. He uses a little bit of wordplay, so stay with me here a second. But it's a righteousness based on faith. And the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? What he means is, look, how to be right with God is not something you got to go pry hard out of heaven and just kind of somehow, if I could just get heaven to tell me how to be right with God. You don't have to do that. Christ has already done that. Or who can descend into the abyss? You don't have to go down into the place where death is. You don't have to raid the gates of hell. You don't have to go be victorious over Satan so you can somehow come back and say, wow, I figured out what salvation is. Christ already did that. No, salvation is incredibly simple. The word is near you. It's in your mouth and in your heart. This is the word of faith we proclaim, because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and you believe in your heart that God raised you from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame, for there's no distinction between Jew and Greek. The same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. What's this whole passage about? It is incredibly simple. Do you believe at the heart of hearts, at the depth of where you are, do you believe God saves sinners, and he would save you. Do you believe that? And will you confess that? And I know he says with his mouth, and you go, well, wait a second, why do you guys do baptisms? Because we understand from Romans chapter 6, which has been just before Romans 10, that part of the confession is bury me into Christ. It's part of the confession. But he says, if you will believe and confess, I'll save you. What? I don't get to cash all these chips in? No, they're not worth anything. Well, what about my 20? No, they don't mean anything. Well, what about believe and confess? Now, I said it's simple. I didn't say it's easy. You see, what I want to do with my life is not turn this into a gig. I want it to be my act of worship. It won't mean anything at heaven's gates other than it was just the way I could serve the King best I knew. But a surrendered life is the only thing my salvation comes on. And if I don't have surrender, nothing else takes its place. Is that you? Have you slipped into autopilot? Have you gotten mechanical? Has the older brother become who you were? It's a funny thing about salvation. Anyone can do it. Really, I mean, he made it so simple, anyone could do it. You got a 12-year-old boy here who may be a little bit mentally slow, but if he understands that Jesus is Lord and Christ, and I surrender to him, that little boy can have the King of Kings as his father. There may be an alpha male, there's a guy in the audience last week I was visiting with who used that phrase about himself, kind of an alpha male. Well, there's a lot of alpha males who conquer kingdoms and big steps, and I mean, you're absolutely conquering the world. So you're one of those aggressive sort of fellows. Do you know what it's going to take for salvation? God be merciful to me, a sinner. A surrendered life. Didn't say it's easy, but it said it's simple. Last principle I want to say that's for everybody. There's not time to talk about this subject other than just simply say you've been a part of a trend in the last 30, 40 years that basically says salvation is only available to some. You'll get your head really mixed up if you don't understand this text. Romans chapter 9, he says God elects some, and you hear the word elect, and those of you that are church insiders, suddenly now your mind begins to race. You need to know that there's some really bad theology that's been out there for the last 40 years. Chapter 9 says, you're right, God elects people, but he elects them to service, not salvation. You decide what you're going to do with Jesus. The reason Jesus could stand and weep over Jerusalem and say, how I long to gather you like a mother hen gathers her chicks and weep over Jerusalem is because they could have chosen to follow him, but they did not. The reason Peter writes with such passion is that God doesn't will anybody to perish, but all to come to repentance. The reason Jesus even says in John 3:16 that God so loved the world, he gave his begotten Son, that whoever, if that's an open whoever, I don't care who you are, I don't care what your lineage was, what your ethnic background is, I don't care how you've ruined your life, whoever. In fact, that is so strong in this text. In verses 11 through 13, you'll notice how many times he keeps saying it. Just anyone. Chapter 10, verses 11 through 13, everyone, anyone, all, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. It'd be a really cheap, bad trick this morning if we said, wow, we have this fabulous gift here that anybody can have, more valuable than you can imagine, and there's a coupon attached to your seat. All you have to do is bring that coupon in and trade it for this gift. Bad illustration, I know. And so many of you find your coupon from your seat and you come, but others of you check your seat out and go, wow, there's no coupon here. We go, yeah, there was... We didn't choose you. But anybody and everyone, whoever wants to, can have. Anybody can wants to. And you say, but I wasn't given one. There's a form of teaching out called Calvinism that in its radical form, I don't think is biblical. So when you write your letter to me, be sure and sign your name. Because the truth is, whosoever will. And that's what he says in this text. So what's the obstacle? What is the obstacle? He said, well, there's two obstacles. Here are the only two obstacles. Verse 14. The only two obstacles are these. How are they to call on him who they've not believed? And how are they to believe in the one they've never heard? The only two obstacles are these. Do you believe it? And have you heard it? And how are they here without someone preaching? And how are they to be preaching unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. Here's the two great obstacles. Do you believe it? Have you a chance to hear it? Everybody needs a chance to hear. Everybody does. I know this is a bit emotional for me. And those of you who have been here probably longer than 5 years know what I have in my hand. Those of you in here less than five probably don't. It's probably, for religious symbols, I can tell you by far it is the most powerful religious symbol I have in my life. More than anything else I can describe to you, this is a collection and an accumulation of something. It's really high in... It's pink toilet paper. I can't explain to you exactly how God works and how he causes things, but I've been a lot of places and seen different things, I know, but somehow God pulled together at a moment this. I was in Afghanistan 5 or 6 years ago, and I think watching the poverty and the destitute and watching people who so desperately wanted to have something, but they don't, and it was all coming together. Everybody has a right to hear. Thank you, ma'am. Here's a white one. Thank you. But somehow, the traffic was horrible. The traffic was just, it's a quagmire. There's no lanes. There's no order. It's just like a bunch of junior high kids headed toward free food. And only this is 10-wheel trucks and military trucks and taxis and everything under the sun. And as I'm in a taxi, a little 3, maybe 4-year-old little Afghani girl, beautiful, scared eyes, beautiful dark skin and hair. This little 3-year-old girl, terrified, is standing in the middle of that traffic, bumpers from trucks pushing her left and right. The mirrors are going over the tops of her heads. She's standing in the middle of just a quagmire, and she's holding up a handful of pink toilet paper. And the reason she's doing it is that the family is so poor and so destitute that even your 3-year-old you put in traffic to sell something for that day's food. This pink toilet paper, I wasn't even able to get from her because our taxi driver, just as I'm rolling my window out to get it from her, the taxi driver finds a little opening to the left and he shoots around. So all I could do was turn and watch out the back window as her face disappeared and the traffic swallowed her up. I went back and I cried. What kind of world is it that people have to struggle so hard and do not know of grace and do not know of the love of God, and tons of things came together for me. I asked some friends in Afghanistan in Kabul to buy this, to find her, and this is from her. And I hold in my hand something that God captured my heart with that everybody has the right to know. Everybody has the right to know. And how dare you, with your rights and your privileges, forget the story of grace for yourself and you forget how much everybody else needs it? How dare you? We asked you last week to pray for 3 people. This week we ask you to speak to 3 people. We ask you to Last week, to pray for 3 people who don't know Jesus Christ. This week, we ask you as your assignment, would you speak? Would you write the letter you need to write? Not the preachery letter. Probably just your own story. A story of what grace has done in my life and what it means to me. I don't know how you do it, but would you tell the story of grace to 3 people? The very last verse in this chapter speaks of God who holds out his hands all day long to a stubborn people. The invitation hymn is, if you've been playing your gig and you're ready to give it up, would you come to a God who holds out his hands? Would you stand as we sing?